As always, all the sources for this episode will be listed on our show notes. I'm Darlene, Melody's my co-host, and you're listening to Hard Times and True Crimes.
An oracle within my heart concerning the transgression of the wicked. There is no fear of God before his eyes, for he flatters himself in his own eyes when he finds out his iniquity and when he hates. The words of his mouth are wickedness and deceit. He has ceased to be wise and to do good. He devises wickedness on his bed. He sets himself in a way that is not good, and he does not abhor evil. Psalm 36, 1 through 4.
Hello, everybody. This is part two of a two-part episode about the Wineville chicken coop murders that happened back in the 1920s. If you haven't listened to part one, I suggest you go back and listen to that one first so that you're not lost. I also wanted to add the disclaimer that this case has been by far the most difficult one yet. The details are disturbing and, like Melody said last week, will probably stick with you. So if you can't listen to this one, we completely understand and we hope that you'll check back with us next week.
If you're a child, you do not need to listen to this. Turn it off and go ask your parent. And parents, if your child asks to listen, tell them no.
When we left off last week, 12-year-old Sanford was living out on a chicken farm with his 21-year-old uncle, Gordon Northcott. Sanford was being routinely beat, tortured, and raped by his uncle. During the day, he was working the chicken farm and keeping it running basically by himself, as well as cooking all of the meals, doing all of the housework, and anything else that Uncle Gordon took a whim for him to do. He would often have to sleep out in the chicken coop, just like one of the animals. Mm-hmm. Sanford was allowed to write home, but of course, his uncle was dictating every word of every letter written. Like I mentioned in the last episode, these letters were all about how wonderful Uncle Gordon was treating him, and all of the fun stuff that they were doing together, how he loved school, Boy Scouts, and farming. You get the idea. All these letters are just praising the uncle.
Yeah.
If Winnie, Sanford's mom, had any guilt over sending her 12-year-old son to another country to live and work with her brother, these letters probably alleviated that guilt. I want to believe that she did have guilt and that she missed her son. I want to think that she only allowed him to go because she really believed that it was what was best for him and not because she just wanted to get him out of her hair.
And is there a reason why you think that maybe that's not the reason?
There are many reports that say that she was actually pretty verbally abusive to Sanford.
Oh, she was too?
Yeah, and that she treated him with the same contempt that she treated his father, her husband. That she just kind of berated men. And, you know, you can see where she may have got that from.
Well, I was going to say, like mother, like daughter.
Exactly. Sanford's older sister, Jessie, that he was really close with, later said she'd hoped going to the U.S. with their uncle would be better for Sanford than being at home with their mother, who was constantly berating him.
Oh, how sad for that kid.
But when Jessie read these letters Sanford was writing home, she just did not believe that they were from him. She knew he'd physically written the letters, but the words were not his.
Mm-hmm.
Their mom, Winnie, though, she wouldn't hear any of Jessie's concerns. And, you know, what could Jessie do? She was a kid herself.
Yeah, how old was she?
Well, when he left home, she was 15.
Okay.
She was young.
She's not an adult by any means.
No. Meanwhile, Sanford was just trying to survive mm-hmm. as best as he could while enduring unspeakable acts of violence. And I mean that when I say mm-hmm. unspeakable. I literally cannot retell some of the things that were done to this boy because they're so horrific. His Uncle Gordon would taunt Sanford by calling him his new little darling.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah. He would have this evil grin on his face and, oh, he was just sick.
He is a piece of trash.
He is. Sanford tried to stay occupied with the hundreds of chickens, the ducks, the goats. Usually the busier he stayed, the better, because Gordon needed the work done. His grandparents would sometimes visit. When his grandpa, George, was around, Uncle Gordon never beat or raped him. Sanford looked forward to those visits and hated it when Grandpa George would go back home.
Mm-hmm.
So when Grandpa George came, he didn't want to be around his wife or his son. So he would stay outside and he'd oversee Sanford with what was happening on the farm. Grandpa George was all about hard work and he wanted the farm to turn a profit because he had money tied up in it. He wanted back his investment.
Sure.
So when he came to town, he and Sanford often would work together. He was quiet. You know, like I said, he was kind of this beat down old man, but he'd give Sanford some advice and tips on how to run things. As far as Grandma Louise went, Sanford had just learned to completely stay out of her way. But the grandparents would inevitably leave and it would go back to just being him and his Uncle Gordon. And that was the worst because Gordon would have these days of pent up aggression built up and no one to take it out on but Sanford.
He was itching probably to be able to, like you said, just release that.
Yeah. There were no good days there, but there was this one day that a piano was delivered to the farm. That piano gave Sanford a short and much needed respite from the abuse that had become a part of his everyday life. For a while, it occupied and even calmed Gordon. He would stay inside for days at a time, practicing. He would pretend to be playing for large audiences and even make Sanford come and listen to him play a song if he, you know, wanted to show off. It was a relief for Sanford when he heard that piano being played. It meant that Uncle Gordon's mind was not on him.
Yeah.
But before long, Uncle Gordon was his old, nervous, hollering, hateful self, just as violent and sadistic as ever. A lot of times when he was at the peak of these bad moods, either Sanford would get it worse or Gordon would leave the farm and drive his car across the border into Mexico looking for a young boy that he could lure back to the farm. He would promise them jobs and those kinds of things. These boys were easy prey because once they were over the border, no one would be looking for them.
Right.
Once they were on the farm, the boy would be chained up in one of the chicken houses, tortured and raped for days and sometimes weeks. Sanford would hear screams. He knew what shock and horror they were experiencing. But there was nothing that he could do for them. He would try to block it all out. It was just kind of another form of torture.
For him, sure.
Yeah.
Was. Yeah.
Sometimes some of the boys would be forced to work on the farm for a few weeks. Sometimes his parents would even come in. So Sanford's grandparents would come in.
Mm-hmm.
And
so they would see these boys.
They would
there?
See these boys. Gordon would just say, oh, yeah, they're just working for me. And they would turn a blind eye.
Because that's what they do.
But inevitably, at some point, Gordon would get sick of the boy. They would leave the farm together. He always had some story about how the boy had either been released or run away. But more than likely, these boys were murdered.
Mm-hmm.
When Gordon would return home after, quote, letting the boys go, he was always in a better mood. He was calmer. He would even sometimes be nice to Sanford. It was in these times that Uncle Gordon would want to give Sanford life advice and seem to actually care about him. Okay, well, he didn't seem like he hated him.
Right. That was like the closest he could come.
Yeah. He would let Sanford read detective books when, you know, when he was in these good moods or cowboy books. He'd joke around with him sometimes and often sadistically, but it was Gordon's sick way. He genuinely thought that he was being funny.
Mm.
Sanford would later say his uncle pranced around like a schoolgirl when he was in these moods, almost giddy after returning from these trips. But those moods never lasted, and the routine physical assaults and brutal rapes would inevitably continue for Sanford.
Mm-hmm.
Gordon was comfortable with leaving Sanford on the farm alone for days or however long he felt like being gone now. Sometimes he'd go to visit his parents and who knows what else he was up to, but he trusted that Sanford would not run away, and he wasn't wrong.
And I guess he just had that kid scared so bad because, I mean, I'm thinking when he would have those other boys there at some point, you know, you're like, why don't you two just plot to overcome him and beat the crap out of him? But, you know, again, when you're not in that situation, you don't know what's going on in their brain and how they've been manipulated and just all of those things.
And Gordon had a gun. You know, sometimes I wonder, like, why didn't he leave when he was gone? Now we know about the Stockholm syndrome.
Right, exactly. And probably a lot of, like, there's probably a lot of mental health that goes into that situation.
Oh, yeah.
That you really can't comprehend when you haven't experienced that kind of trauma. Sure. And I'm not talking about Gordon's mental illness, which, again, gives him no excuse. I'm talking about Sanford undergoing such trauma. There's probably a lot of, you know, just a lot of stuff going on there. A lot of layers.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Yeah, I agree. He had Sanford convinced that he was stuck forever, and as bad as that was, the alternative was worse.
Right. He was convinced that, like, why would you try to get away when you know I'm only going to run to something that's worse? And that was what he really believed.
He felt really dirty
for
what was happening to him, which is so sad to me. Mm-hmm. But he said that it would break his heart to think about his sister seeing him, like, and he just couldn't.
He was carrying, like, shame and humiliation.
Yes. Yeah. But when Gordon would go away, Sanford could take his time doing his chores. He could build a fire at night and read, which he loved to do. It just gave him a chance to relax a little bit, mentally anyway. He still had to get all of his work done, but he could take his time and...
He probably didn't have to walk around with, like, that knot of worry in his stomach about what's going to happen in the next minute.
Yes, that's exactly right. But ultimately, he'd hear the sound of the tires crunch in the gravel and Uncle Gordon's car driving up that long driveway. One afternoon, after being gone all morning, Gordon drove up and called Sanford to come out to the car. He told him that he had a present for him. Of course, Sanford was confused, but Gordon took this galvanized tar bucket out of the floor of his back seat and told Sanford to come here, check it out. There was this old dirty towel over the top of the bucket, and it was covering whatever was inside. So Sanford just kind of looked inside, but he was probably nervous because he knows how weird his uncle is and didn't know what, you know, what was going to be a snake or who knows.
Yeah.
But anyway, he looked inside, but he couldn't make out exactly what it was. It was bloody, maybe a dead animal. Mm. His uncle kept laughing and saying, do you know what it is? Finally, Sanford realized that it wasn't fur that he was seeing. It was black hair that was still attached to a human head.
Oh.
He could tell that the head belonged to a Mexican boy or a Native American. Sanford felt nauseous. I mean, he couldn't believe what he was seeing.
No.
And Gordon was like, I could not help it. I couldn't help it. This was self-defense. This Mexican tried to kill me and I had to defend myself. There's not a judge in California that would convict me of this because a man's got a right to defend himself. Anyway, I cut off his head, so there's no way that he's going to be identified. Mm. This is the stuff he's saying.
This man is full on crazy.
He is. He told Sanford the rest of him is buried in the desert. And you know what? He was right, because to this day, nobody knows who that boy was.
How tragic.
It's so sad. He made Sanford burn the boy's head in a fire. He made him keep it stoked and burning the whole day and then bury it. Gordon told Sanford that that boy was bigger than him and to remember, look at all that's left of him. I did that and I could easily do the same thing to you. So you just keep that in mind.
And those were the kind of tactics that he used to keep him from running away.
Yeah, and it worked. Gordon and Sanford then went to stay a few days with Gordon's parents. Gordon actually told his parents about the murder.
Wait,
yeah.
Wait, what?
Yeah, he actually told them. On the way there, He concocted this story and said, Sanford, you're going to back me up on this because they'll believe you. He had Sanford lie and say that he had helped with the killing, that he had been there and that it was self-defense. Of course, Gordon was the hero.
I was going to say, why is he even telling this story at all?
I think he just could not resist. He wanted to be the hero.
He did.
So he was telling, you know, this, he was trying to hurt me. He was trying to hurt Sanford and, of course, making up this big
ridiculous
lie.
Stuff.
Right. Grandpa George was horrified, and he actually yelled at Gordon when he told him about decapitating the boy. Mm. But Grandma Louise told her husband that he should be thankful that their son survived this. She was just happy that he was alive, that he needed their compassion right now, not their judgment. Do not yell at him. And Gordon just burst into tears.
Ugh.
She ran over and she, you know, held her baby. Gordon just had her full support.
Yeah, gag me.
Even in this murder, Gordon asked his mama if him and her could go see a movie that night because he was feeling so nervous about what had happened and he needed to take his mind off of things.
Mm-hmm.
So Sanford spent the evening puking.
Yeah.
As he processed all of everything that had happened that day. Sanford and the grandpa, like, they didn't even
discuss it.
It's the weirdest thing.
These family dynamics are the most bizarre thing I've ever heard.
A few days later, on February 2nd, 1928, a young boy's headless body was found in the spot where Uncle Gordon said that he'd left it. After that, Sanford, again, tried to settle back down into a routine as normal as possible under the circumstances. He was starting to get a little older now, which meant he really wasn't holding his uncle's attention as much anymore because his uncle was attracted to very young boys.
Mm.
So although he was regularly sexually assaulted about twice a week, Gordon would bring other boys from across the border over pretty regularly as well.
The level of depravity is just unimaginable.
About a month after the murder, on March 10th, is when Walter Collins went missing. Walter is the little boy from episode one that Melody told us about last week. Walter's mother had to go into work that evening, and he had wanted to go to the movies. I'm just refreshing because I know you've already told this, but he wanted to go to the movies, so she gave him some money. I think a dime, was it?
Yep.
It seems unbelievable now that a child would go get into a car with a stranger, but remember that this was a different time. This was the 20s.
Mm-hmm.
Kids obeyed adults.
Yeah, they didn't have those words, stranger danger, and
no,
all of that. Yeah.
And you think about it, Gordon Northcott, he was young. He had a nice car. He could put on a show. I think he was very charming when he wanted to be.
Mm-hmm.
He could pretend to be really nice, and especially when it came to young boys.
Mm-hmm.
Gordon probably seemed pretty cool.
Right.
To a young boy.
And I think I read somewhere that at one point Gordon had worked in a grocery store. Are you getting to that?
Yep.
Sorry.
Yeah, no, that's fine. It's also believed that Walter Collins and his mother may have actually known Gordon because he had worked at a grocery store that was close to their home. And Walter would often pick up the groceries for his mom. You know, they may not, you know, been like BFFs or anything, but it's highly probable that Gordon was not a complete stranger to Walter.
This is someone in your community that you maybe if you see them, you know, on a regular basis, they don't feel like a stranger. They don't feel dangerous.
Exactly. So if Gordon were to see him walking down the road, I mean, that would
offer him a ride home.
Yeah, that wouldn't be weird to him, probably.
Right.
So up until this point, Gordon had been very careful to only bring Mexican workers to the farm that he felt no one would look for this side of the border.
Mm-hmm.
And I think at this point, he had just lost whatever little bit of self-control he had.
Right.
And he didn't have much to begin with,
exactly.
Obviously.
Yeah.
Gordon saw Walter walking home alone and told him he could come out to the farm and play with all the animals. Told him that they had horses out there.
Mm.
He promised he'd have him back before his mom got off from work. And now we only know this from Sanford.
Mm-hmm.
When he drove up that evening with Walter Collins, he told Sanford, come out to the car. He wanted him to meet someone, probably introducing him to put Walter at ease.
Yeah, and probably Samford obviously probably already thought, oh no, again. Yes.
Yeah.
And Gordon probably knew that and wanted to make him feel that way.
Oh, he did. Walter was asking about the horses.
Oh, he still didn't know.
All the other times Gordon had brought boys home, there had been a language barrier. So while he felt bad for them, he couldn't understand what they were saying. He couldn't really communicate with them. And for him, it made it a little bit easier somehow. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah. Again, he's probably developed the only coping mechanisms mm-hmm. available to him.
Right. Walter kept asking him, where are the horses? Oh. And Samford could see him starting to get scared.
How awful that must have been.
Yeah. And he realized that there were no horses. And he just kept asking at this point, well, I want to go home. Mm-hmm. Like, I need to go home to my mom. My mom's going to be worried about me.
Oh, that is just heartbreaking.
Gordon would almost immediately chain Walter up inside one of the chicken coops. That first night, Samford could hear Walter screaming out. He tried not to think about him. He tried to read one of his westerns, but he couldn't get this little boy off of his mind. He cried that first night because he felt so sorry for him. He would have liked to have rescued him.
Mm-hmm.
He thought about it. You know,
he just didn't.
There was no way.
Yeah.
For the next few days, Samford tried not to go anywhere near Walter. He didn't want to see him. He didn't want to deal with it. He just wanted to forget that the little boy was there. Samford was internally conflicted as well because, and he hated himself for this, because although he really did feel so bad for what he knew Walter was going through, he was also relieved that it wasn't happening to him.
Mm.
Although he didn't want to go near him, his uncle forced Samford to bring food and water to Walter. He also forced him to bathe him.
Mm.
When he went out to him, Walter was crying. He had blood and dirt all over him. By this time, he already had bruises everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
This was so pitiful to me because Samford would later say that Walter kept telling Samford, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'll be good.
Oh.
Will you tell him I'll be good? I don't care about the horses.
Oh,
I know.
Just the tragedy of that. I mean, I can't even process it. Oh.
He said that he kept asking Samford to please tell Gordon he was sorry, that he would be good now. He just missed his mom and he just wanted to go home. Samford looked at him and said, look, Walter, please just do whatever he asks you to do and it's going to be okay. You'll get to go home. One day, Samford was outside working and his grandmother pulled up in the driveway. Gordon was actually inside the coop when she pulled up, abusing Walter at that very moment. When Grandma Louise got out of the car and she asked where Gordon was, at first Samford didn't know what to say. He would get in trouble if it was a moment of, like, what do I do? But she was like, I said, where is Gordon? So Samford was kind of nervous, but he thought, this is it. You know, I may be in trouble, but at least Walter's going to be saved. So he pointed to the coop. Grandma went in, and when she came out, she was screaming and hollering. She was mortified. And for the first time, mad at her little baby boy. That was the first time Samford had ever seen his grandmother upset with her precious son.
She was mad at this monster she had created.
Yes.
That she had contributed to mm-hmm. his deviant behavior.
Exactly. She was cussing him out, asking him how he could do this. She said, I've turned my head to your...
Yes, you have, and that's the problem.
Yes. She said she'd believed him before when he had given her that self-defense story with the other boy, and she had helped him when he was in trouble. Now this...
And gotten him out of his previous charges for molesting a young boy. You can't help but just be mad hearing what her words were.
Oh, I know. And Gordon started crying and saying, I'm sorry, Mother. I'm so sorry. I just couldn't control myself. You know, that hardly happens anymore when I just lose control. But Louise told him to shut his mouth. Gordon was hysterical because, I mean, really, if he didn't have her, who did he have? So he kept telling his mother, I promise this will never happen again. I just lost control. I messed up, Mother. I need you. Louise just went outside and she went back into the chicken coop with Walter. He was crying and he told her the same thing that he'd told Sanford. I'll be good. I'm sorry. I just miss my mom.
Heartbreaking.
She told him it's okay. And she soothed him and she let him lay down and he rubbed his back and he comforted him until he went to sleep. Then she went back inside where Gordon and Sanford were. She told them that they were going to have to kill Walter.
Because she had to protect Gordon. Mm-hmm. So she, yeah.
And the quietest way that could be done was with an axe.
Oh, gosh.
Sanford was just stunned. He's endured a lot.
And he's witnessed a lot.
But this almost put him over the edge. He just started crying. He could not believe it. He really thought his grandma Louise would make Gordon turn the boy loose because, you know, this was a local boy. And now he felt like, I'm the one that told her.
That maybe sealed his death sentence.
Yeah, yeah, that's how he felt. Grandma Louise not only said that he had to be killed, but told Gordon and Sanford that each of them was going to have to hit the boy with the axe so that none of them could tell on each other. Mm. It was going to be all three of them.
So she's conniving to protect herself too.
Yes. Sanford said, please don't do this. Mm-mm. His grandma looked at him and said, you don't understand the bond between a mother and her son.
Oh my gracious. This woman is straight up whack. They are all just whack.
This was
the ultimate of what you would do.
Anything. She would literally do anything for her son. She told Sanford that this was actually an act of mercy for Walter. And that if he didn't help, though, the same thing could be done to him.
So she wasn't beyond threatening him either.
Oh, no.
Well, she's not beyond anything. I mean, obviously, like no shred of decency there at all.
No.
In her or nor her son. So, I mean, like at this point, nothing should be surprising, but it is.
It is, of course.
It's shocking. It's still hard to wrap your mind around.
All hope at this point was lost for Sanford.
Yeah.
They went out to the shed and each hit Walter with the axe. First, Grandma hit him twice, and then she handed it over to Sanford. He didn't take it at first. You know, he just stood mm-hmm. there. He was trying not to take it when Gordon picked up a small hatchet and threw it at him, and it hit him in the arm and cut him. So he was bleeding and he stunned, and he literally had no choice but to hit Walter.
Yeah. And he knew if he didn't, they would have killed him.
Grandma Louise told Sanford that Walter was already dead anyway, but that he just had to hit him so that it would be fair. And then last, Gordon hit Walter 3 or 4 times. I mean, it wasn't even necessary. Mm-mm. I have no words. Mm-mm. So now they've all got something on each other, I guess. That was Louise's angle. Afterwards, Louise and Gordon stood in the hen house talking while they made Sanford dig Walter's grave. He dug and threw up simultaneously.
I'm sure. Yeah.
But as far as Grandma Louise and Gordon went, their problem was no longer a problem. So they went on about their day and Grandma left to go home the next morning.
Just like nothing ever happened.
Just like nothing happened. And Gordon would say to Sanford, now you're one of us. Sanford tried to go back to life as usual after this, you know, just kind of get lost in his reading and his work.
Which, like, life as usual for him, not a normal life.
That's exactly right. But at this point, like I had mentioned earlier, he had just lost all hope. He was realizing how easily that he could lose his life here. Mm-hmm.
He could be disposed of and disappear and...
Yeah. And after that, really, he was fully expecting to be murdered at some point when he was of no use to mm-hmm. Gordon. Back home, though, in Saskatchewan, his dad had left his mother and his sister, Jessie, had moved out of her mother's house as well and into her own apartment. Jessie had grown suspicious enough over the letter Sanford was sending, and she and her dad started talking about this. Like, I just don't. You know, no. Something's not right. So she started working and saving money, and so did her dad. You have to think, this was a bad time. This was in the late 20s.
Yeah.
So these definitely were hard times. Money just wasn't growing on trees. they had to work for a while.
Right. And we already talked about the expense of the train ticket that Christine had to pay for to get the not real Walter back.
Right.
It was $70 back then.
Yeah, that's a lot of money. Yeah. Wasn't that?
And that was one way.
Yeah.
So I'm sure Jesse's trying to look for a round trip.
Right. So Sanford had no way of knowing there were people out there who were thinking of him.
Right. Yeah, but I'm sure he felt so alone.
Yeah. Even though Gordon swore to his mother that he would never do again what he had done with Walter Collins, within a couple of months, he was out prowling around for little boys again. He actually had two failed kidnap attempts. He saw this one little boy at a park. The little boy was with his parents, but his parents were off, you know, occupied somewhere mm-hmm. else. So he had been playing with the boy and just being how he is with little kids. And the boy was having fun with them. He was enjoying, you know, playing with this older guy. Then he asked if he could tickle him. And that freaked him out a little bit.
Yeah, again, that creepy behavior.
Yeah, and he was like, no. So he started to go back with his parents. But then Gordon was like, hey, I have a puppy in my car. You would love him. Why don't you come and see it? And so the little boy was like, okay. He runs over there. Well, Gordon tries to grab him, but he screams, and thank God his dad hears him.
Yes.
And he runs over there and rescues his son. He reports it, but I guess nothing ever came of it.
And I'm sure, I guess at that point, Gordon ran off. But
yeah.
So thankfully, one kid.
Actually, two got away. Another kid fought him off. Punched him and was able to physically fend him off. So he was out there, mm-hmm. you know, trying.
Well, I mean, he's a predator.
Predator. He is. Yeah.
I didn't realize that even back then people were using the puppy excuse.
Right.
To lure.
And horses. Surprising. And, you know, he knew what he was doing. These kids lived in the city. So they
It was like maybe a novelty for them.
Definitely the horses. I mean, that was probably a huge deal.
Yeah.
On May 16th, 1928, Gordon Northcott would kidnap two brothers, Lewis Winslow, who was 12 years old, and Nelson Winslow, who was 10. The boys lived 20 miles from Wineville in Pomona, California. They were walking home from a model yacht club meeting. Mm. I just have to say, I have boys that are 2 years apart, and I cannot help but think of them when they were these ages.
Yeah. And me too.
Especially because little Nelson played the banjo, and I have a banjo playing boy.
You do.
Too. Aww. And the other little brother had a book, a library book, that he'd been reading, and he carried it with him everywhere. And these boys, they came from a good family. They were very loved, their parents' only children, and they were adventurous. I mean, they were just all boys.
It was just your typical American boyhood, it sounds like.
The Winslow family, they were pretty well off.
You said yacht club. I thought, that sounds,
Yeah, this was not a poor family. So again, Gordon Northcott is getting very brazen.
Mm-hmm.
He's not in control anymore.
Mm.
Gordon brings the boys to the farm. And just like he always does, he chains these little boys up in a chicken coop. Mm. He was a little more nervous, though, because he knew that their parents would be looking for them.
Mm-hmm.
Again, he dictated two letters for the boys to write home to their parents, saying that they had gone to Mexico to find work and adventure. They were having a great time and that they were being fed by this really nice lady. They were traveling at night and sleeping during the day. And these letters were confusing because the parents recognized the handwriting. It was their boy's handwriting, but they knew that
they just didn't sound like their son.
No, they were very close with their boys. Mm-hmm. They just knew.
Yeah.
Their sons were not runaways. The parents never believed that the boys left home on their own, but the police did.
Yeah. So they're not getting a lot of support probably just based on that.
I think they were looking for them, but they weren't all in like, this is definitely a kidnapping. They were looking into a lot of different
options and avenues they were still considering.
Exactly. Their parents kept the light on for them at night. for when they would make their way back home. The dad said, you know, they're good boys. They're going to come back home.
Oh.
Makes me so stinking sad. After Gordon had finished with them, he told Sanford that the boys had to be killed. He made Sanford help him with killing the little boys. And the quietest way is with an axe. So Gordon killed Nelson, the oldest brother, first. And he did this right in front of his little brother.
How horrible.
Sanford would later say that Nelson was so traumatized. He said that killing him at that point was almost a mercy. You and I talked about that earlier, and you said, you know, that was probably just a way for Sanford to cope with what he had to do.
Yeah, I mean, he had to have told himself something. I mean, because that's traumatic for him, being forced to do something so horrid. And his grandmother had already said it before and planted that seed. So I'm sure he grasped onto that and told himself, well, it's a mercy to him now.
Yeah, I think so, too. In July of 1928, Sanford's sister, Jessie, finally had enough money saved, and she hightailed it to California to check on her baby brother. It didn't take her long to see that things were not right. First of all, her Uncle Gordon would not let her be alone with her brother at all. And that, you know, that's just weird.
Yeah, telling, very telling.
She couldn't believe how thin and malnourished her brother looked.
Mm.
He had obviously been beat up. She saw that scar on his back.
Oh, yeah, that boiling
water. From that boiling water. She noticed how he was walking like he was in pain.
Oh.
And we know that that's probably from the sexual abuse that he was suffering through.
Mm.
He avoided all eye contact with her, which was so strange because they were extremely close. She'd expected him to be excited to see her, and instead, he tried his best not to be around her at all.
Yeah.
He was actually telling her that he was busy and she should just go back home. The whole thing was just off anyway. So one night after their Uncle Gordon went to sleep, Jessie took the opportunity to take Sanford outside and begged him, please talk to me. Tell me what's going on. He told her that he was worried about her. He told her to please go back home. He was worried that she was going to be killed. And the floodgates came open. He told her about Gordon and the sexual abuse, about how little boys had even been murdered there. And Jessie was stunned. She cried. She could not believe what she was hearing. This is her brother that she loves, and she's so worried for him.
And she's hearing this about her grandparents, too.
Yes. So she gave Sanford money, and she said, please meet me on the train. He told her that he would, knowing that he was not going to do that. But Jessie left the farm, and she stayed a couple of nights with her grandparents before she left. And when she was there, she managed to talk privately with her Grandpa George. And they made a plan to try to help her get Sanford away from Gordon.
Mm.
He picked Sanford up without Gordon realizing it. He took him to a friend of his house.
The grandpa did?
The grandpa did. And asked the friend to please keep him there until they could get him a train out of there.
Okay.
And he had money. He had his fare. I'm not saying he was a great guy. That was a risk that he did take. And I am thankful for that.
After all the times he's turned a blind eye, that's the least he could do.
Exactly. Well, it didn't take long before Gordon found out.
Probably from
the grandma.
Yeah.
So Gordon punched his dad in the face, and he went right over there and picked Sanford up from his dad's friend's house. He said he could not live without Sanford.
Man.
He threatened his dad, telling him that he would kill him if he ever tried anything like that again. And I'm sure Sanford had hell to pay for that, too.
Yeah.
But when Jessie got back to Canada, she didn't wait around to see what was going to happen. She called the American consul and reported that her brother was being held on the Northcott farm against his will.
Good for her.
That he had been brought into the country illegally and had been brought across the border with falsified paperwork. I don't even know if that's true, but that's what she told them.
And so good on her. She knew that that would get their attention and that they would follow up on that. And I'm so, so glad.
Oh, I know. And so that's why then on August 31st of 1928, those immigration officers showed up at the farm. We know now at this point, they've got Sanford in custody. He's told them everything. And Christine Collins was just hearing about the murders and that Walter was said to be one of Northcott's victims. But she absolutely did not believe it. And I get that. First of all, she probably didn't want to believe it because right. who would want to believe that? But second of all, look at what she had gone through with the cops. She probably thought they're just trying to close this case.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
she had to have been a little, she's not going to be quick to believe them. Yeah.
No, I mean, she had just gotten out of that asylum. I mean, I think the day before, a couple of days before. So she's not going to, you know, just believe everything she's hearing. The former district attorney, who still worked for the district attorney's office, was called in to help on this case. And his name was Loyal Kelly. And I love this man. He is a hero to me. He went to visit Sanford and to talk to him about everything that had gone on. Because, you know, he had to, he was decided.
Right, because he just confessed to murder.
To murders, right? Yeah. At first, Sanford wouldn't look him in the eye. He was deeply ashamed. He was afraid of what was going to become of him. He thought that he was being looked at just like any other criminal. Because again, you know, he had committed murder and admitted it.
And I'm sure he carried such a tremendous weight of guilt over that.
Oh, yeah. He knew that he had done terrible things, even if it was forced.
Right.
He had his
that
hand.
Whole that whole internal conflict that he's dealing with.
Exactly. But Mr. Kelly was compassionate and he believed what Sanford was saying. And he deeply sympathized with this boy who had endured so much. He spent a lot of time with him, visiting with him, and convincing him that he was not to blame. And that he knew that everything he had done had been because he was a victim as well.
That's good. That he, you know, just tried to let Sanford know, you are just as much a victim.
Right, right. And he even told him, you know, thinking he was delivering some good news, saying, I've got good news. We're going to release you into general population. You can make friends. But Sanford begged him not to. And Kelly was kind of taken off guard by this when, like, why? Why wouldn't you go out there? You can, you know, play ball. You can. And Sanford told him that he was still bleeding down there and that he couldn't get it to stop. And he didn't think he could survive the rapes. That would probably come.
That is just the most...
Because remember...
Yeah, what his uncle had told him.
Yes.
That is the most awful, awful thing.
Mm. And they knew that he had suffered some stuff, but they did not know the extent of Sanford's ordeal until then. And that this had happened to him at least twice weekly for the past 2 years. And that if he had been bad or what his uncle had called bad, that he'd been raped using just unbelievable stuff. And Kelly flipped out on the staff of that detention center for not getting him medical attention. He's like, you're questioning this kid. You're doing all this stuff. And he is in pain. He immediately had him sent to a hospital to be treated for his extensive injuries. Kelly also explained that these were scare tactics that his uncle had used against him, and they were absolutely not going to happen there. He told Sanford that he had informants at that detention center and that they would be looking out for him. And if anybody, inmate or guard or whoever, were to bother him, that they would have him to deal with and that they knew they did not want that. He was his protector. Kelly really became Sanford's biggest ally, along with his sister, Jessie.
So now he has another person in his camp.
He grew to trust him, and he kind of became like a father figure to him throughout this whole thing. It makes me want to cry.
I know. I'm sitting here tearing up.
Kelly helped Jessie to get back to California, where he put her with a family in protective custody. Because by this time it was common knowledge that she had been the one to make the call to authorities. And as long as her grandmother and uncle were at large, she wasn't safe. So in late October, Sanford and Jessie were reunited.
Oh.
And they said that she just held him, you know, like a mother, and that it was just the sweetest thing that she would just go visit with him and he would laugh or he could, you know, just be a kid and be loved. And it wasn't just Gordon and Louise on the run. Winnie, Sanford and Jessie's own mother, when she heard about the allegations against her brother and mother by her children, instead of running to her son, ran to join her mother and brother and tried to help them in their escape.
What?
Yes. This absolutely sickened
me. Why in the world? This whole family is just garbage.
Yep.
Garbage. And that's the nice word because I don't cuss.
Yes. Yep. After a few weeks, when he realized that this wasn't going away, not even...
sorry for my sniffling on here.
No, no. I mean, it's terrible. Not even she and her mother could bail Gordon out of this one. So Winnie left the pair of them and eventually publicly admonished herself for taking their side over her son's. Obviously, nobody sympathized with her behind. And
yeah, well, good.
Yeah, she did, however, manage to avoid being charged with conspiracy, which I hate that. I wish she had been charged.
She should have been.
On September 18th, Gordon and his mom split up because they knew that everybody was looking for them as a pair. But they weren't any good apart, and they were both caught the same day in British Columbia. While fighting extradition to the U.S., Gordon gave an interview to the Vancouver Daily Sun, and this is what he had to say. Quote, "There have been a lot of stories circulated about me. They are all untrue. What awful things to say about a man. Some people have been suffering from too much imagination, and a lot of people will be sorry when this case is cleared up. I had to protect poor little mother from this. I simply could not tell her of it. I simply could not tell her of what they were accusing me. If poor little mother had known these charges, it would have killed her. Well, poor little mother and her baby boy lost their case, and they were extradited back to the U.S. to face their charges."
Good.
In Canada, Louise had already admitted to murdering Walter Collins. But when she came back to the U.S., she recanted again.
Oh, she tried to change her story.
Right. Mr. Winslow, the Winslow brothers' dad, you know, the little boys that we had talked about, Lewis and Nelson, their dad actually led a lynch mob to the Riverside County Jail, where Northcott was being temporarily held, but police did convince the mob to disband and to let justice take its course. And I cannot say I blame him.
Oh, I don't blame him at all.
I'm not for mob justice, but this...
In that case?
In that case, yeah, I don't know. I'm not going to say anything else because I just...
I guess that's why we don't do mob justice, because people have to go through the... They have to get a fair trial just in case they weren't guilty.
Right. And it does happen that sometimes...
And it does, but...
But we just know, though, that he's not...
Since we know that he's guilty, it's just like we want the worst for him.
Gordon and his mother were tried separately. Louise was charged with Walter Collins' murder, and Gordon with the Winslow brothers, as well as the headless Mexican boy, even though no one knew who he was. Oh, so sad. That I hate that, too, because he had a family. We don't, you know what I mean? Like, we can't even tell his story because we don't know it.
Don't even know his name.
Gordon's trial was first, and it began on January 11th in 1929. And in true Gordon Northcott fashion, he thought he was smarter than everyone, and he fired his attorneys so that he could represent himself. He felt that he could do a much better job, of course, than
those
educated attorneys.
Yeah. Which sounds like a true narcissist.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, obviously he is. He's a lot of things. While I may not be a professional psychiatrist, I can label him, and I don't think anybody would disagree. He's a sadist. He's a narcissist. He's a psychopath.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's sick. I believe another reason... Honestly, that he decided to do this is because he knew that Sanford was going to have to testify and that he would be the one to cross-examine him if he represented himself. And Gordon was confident in his abilities to intimidate this kid. I mean, he'd done it for
that's what he wanted to
years.
Do.
Yeah. He thought probably that he might even scare him into changing his story. I mean, that's what I think anyway.
I agree.
But it was his constitutional right to represent himself. And even though Kelly argued against it because he knew that was going to be very hard for Sanford and he did not want that, but ultimately the judge allowed it. This was crushing to Sanford. And Kelly sympathized with him, but he encouraged him and he worked with him for weeks to help build his courage and his confidence. And as you can imagine, there were lots of theatrics in the courtroom. Gordon would cross-examine his own self Like, literally, he would ask himself a question and then answer it.
What an idiot.
Yeah, he was so weird.
Again, though, just like, if you think about that just in itself, that level of narcissism, because yes, he wanted that attention on him. And what better way than to just pull theatrics, like you said? I mean, like,
yeah. I don't know. He claimed all sorts of things in court, like that his dad had sexually abused him since he was 10 years old. Now his whole family has denied this. He also said that his sister Winnie was actually his mother and that she had gotten pregnant with him by her own father, George, and that Sanford was actually his brother.
Is there any validity to that?
No.
Okay.
Winnie said that this was an absolute lie. She said all anyone would have to do is to look at his birth certificate. I mean, he was delivered in a hospital. You know, yeah, she just was like, that's not true. I mean, I think a little too late, she was able to see. I don't know. I don't even want to give her any credit because I don't think she deserves any. But anyway, he got up there and lied on her and everybody else he could possibly lie on.
And he actually probably thought people would believe some of his lies.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, it's funny because he had to cross-examine his dad. His dad had to stand up against him, and he did a good job. He told the truth. He would try to intimidate his dad, but his dad stood firm. But when he put his mom on the stand, he asked her, "Are you my real mother?" And she looked at him sheepishly and was like, "No." Ugh. And he was like, "Who is my mother?" And she said, Winnie. Yeah, like she literally would do anything he told her to do, including take the blame for all of the murders, which she did.
They are beyond belief.
Yeah, she said that her son knew about the murders, and so did Sanford and George. But it was me. I killed the boys.
She took what to protect Gordon still?
She's crazy.
She is crazy.
Finally, it was Sanford's turn to testify. If Gordon expected Sanford to be too ashamed, and I'm sure he did, I'm sure he did not think a lot of those details were going to get out. This was the 20s again, and there was a stigma, especially, I think, for boys. But Sanford, he had Kelly in his corner, and
he just needed, you know, somebody behind him supporting him, and he got that.
He did, and he laid everything out on the line. And he wasn't staring down on the ground in shame, but he was looking his uncle in the eye, answering his questions with cool confidence.
Oh, I'm so glad he found the courage to do that.
Me too. And this was a blow to Gordon Northcott's big old ego. He asked Sanford, "Why didn't you save those boys?" And Sanford said, "Well, for one reason, you had the key at night. I couldn't."
Yeah.
You know, that would have been the only real opportunity that I had. Northcott claimed that Nelson was actually murdered by Sanford on his own. Northcott said, and I quote, "I felt sorry for Nelson after I killed Louie. The little one was so distressed and wept so." That was his quote. Sanford may have killed him, but I believe it was forced.
Absolutely. After all that he has suffered through,
right,
I don't think he did any of those things willingly.
No, he was a 13-year-old boy, and anything he did was under extreme duress. It wasn't because he wanted to kill anybody, right, or...
Was he 12 or 13?
Yeah, I think he was 14 at that point.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, when they found him, you said he was 15.
Yeah, so this would have been a few months before that.
Okay.
So he was somewhere between 14 and 15, yeah. Northcott asked Sanford if he was so afraid and thought that he was going to be murdered, then why didn't he run away? Sanford said, "Well, because I figured running away would just speed it up."
Mm.
He asked a bunch of other weird questions like that. It was obvious that Gordon had lost his hold over Sanford, and really he was kind of stumbling all over himself. He wasn't as confident,
yeah,
as he thought he was going to be. After all that, though, the judge allowed Kelly to question Sanford. So he went over and like just smiled at him and just had him answer some questions, basically to clear some stuff up that maybe Gordon had kind of tried to make him look like he had killed the little boy on his own.
I'm sure that Gordon had pictured this in his mind going a different way.
Oh, yeah.
And once it didn't, he, you know, like you said, lost his confidence a little bit. And he was trying to make Sanford look bad.
Yeah.
Nobody's buying that.
No.
He's making himself look worse. And people are probably starting to catch a glimpse of who this, again, piece of crap really is. And so when the next guy comes up, that's going to put Sanford more at ease.
Right.
And I don't think anybody in that courtroom thought badly of Sanford.
No, no. But he just wanted to end it. Mm-hmm. On it. He wanted Gordon to be convicted of both of those murders.
Yes.
And so Kelly visited Sanford later and told him, you know, what a hero he was. And look at the boys that he was saving. You know, that makes me want to cry right there. Like, he was a hero.
Yeah.
That day was the last time that Sanford ever had to be in a room with his uncle again.
Mm.
Now, next, Jesse, his sister, she also had to be cross-examined by her uncle, and she held up just as well, was just as cool and calm and collected. And Kelly had also spent a lot of time with her. And I love him. Like, yes. I just...
And tell me what his title was again.
Well, the state's attorney. He worked with the district attorney's office. Anyway, after that, after Jesse had done her part, Kelly went to see Sanford. You know, he's still in the detention center. Okay. He said, you know, he jumped up and down because he was so happy for his sister. Aww. You know, just... They were just happy.
Yeah.
But anyway, Gordon was found guilty.
Yay! Yes. I've been waiting to hear you say that.
And he was sentenced to hang at San Quentin.
Yay, again.
When he was sentenced to death, his mother begged to also hang. I personally wish they would have obliged her.
What was she begging?
To let her hang with him.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, should've. Yeah.
Or actually, let her hang and not with him, though.
Right.
Like, not together. I wouldn't have conceded to any of her requests, but I would have said, but sure.
Yeah.
We can hang.
Gordon's mother had ended up pleading guilty, as you know, to Walter Collins' murder.
Mm-hmm.
But despite this, Christine Collins, you know, she just didn't believe it. She didn't want to believe it.
Okay, so I'll pick up there for just a moment to add this about Christine Collins. She was desperate for answers, and so she asked to meet with Gordon, and he agreed. She walked away from the meeting believing that her son was still alive. Which I find that to be so sad.
I know. Yeah.
She asked Gordon if he killed Walter, and he gave such bizarre answers that she believed he was crazy. And he was crazy.
Yeah.
Gordon didn't even seem to remember if he had met Walter, so she couldn't really believe he had killed him. And she just clung to that hope that he had gotten away.
Sanford said he does believe there were some boys that were released in the beginning.
Okay.
But I don't think they were American boys.
Okay. Now at this point, for her to be clinging to that hope that Walter was still alive, I mean, she really is reaching for straws there. Well, Gordon sent for Christine and the mother of those Winslow brothers a few days before he was going to be executed. He said he had lied to Christine before when he had denied killing Walter, and now he wanted to clear his conscience before he died.
He has
no conscience, but anyway, he promised he would tell her everything. Just a few hours before his execution, the mothers were at the prison waiting to meet with Gordon, and then he refused to see either of them. He said he didn't know anything.
He said
he was innocent. He claimed his innocence again. He was a sadistic monster.
Yeah.
He enjoyed inflicting this pain on these poor, desperate mothers. It was like one last hoorah for him to be able to inflict pain on somebody.
Yeah.
Christine held the Winslow brothers' mom in her arms as she sobbed and tried to comfort her. She knew that her boys had been there at the farm because they had found Lewis's library book, which some pages had been torn out of to write those letters home to their parents.
Yeah, those boys definitely. There were a lot of evidence that they were there.
They also, the evidence. They also found some of their clothing and some other items that they knew that had belonged to those boys.
Oh, gosh, that's so stinking sad.
Yeah, so you can tell us what happens with Gordon.
Well, after denying those mothers, just letting them know, like, what happened. Because sometimes I think not knowing can be worse for some people. 2 years after the trial, on October 2nd in 1930, Gordon Northcott was led to the scaffold, blindfolded. He had asked to be blindfolded because he was scared. He just didn't want to see what was happening. He was really scared. And it's fitting.
Yeah, I'm like, I'm glad you were scared, but it's so stupid because he has inflicted so much terror on all these innocent young children, mm-hmm. and now you're afraid to face your consequences.
Right. He asked one of the guards, is this going to hurt?
Oh.
He was terrified.
Good.
And how many boys had he made feel that same way?
Mm-hmm.
Just before the trap door fell out from under him, he screamed, "No, don't!" The fall did not break his neck.
Good.
So as he was strangling to death, this guard ran and grabbed him by the legs and pulled him down to stop that jerking.
Mm-hmm.
And he ended up holding on to his legs for 12 minutes until he was pronounced dead.
Wow. Good.
Yep.
I mean, I'm sorry. I know it sounds horrible, but I bet there's not a listener here that doesn't agree that everybody wants to see Gordon suffer.
Yeah, he actually left a note to be read after his execution.
To who?
He left a letter to his mother. He left a letter to his dad. But then he left a letter to be read, I'm thinking, to the jailers. I'm not 100% sure who this is to. But he was making his confession. And what had happened was his dad, George Northcott, and Sanford had killed the boys. And his mom had cleaned up after.
Oh, please. So even to his dying breath and after, he's still trying to turn it around on someone else.
Yep.
He's the victim.
He has no fear of God. I mean,
none.
He was about to.
Well, he's evil.
Yeah. But even the devil knows.
Yeah.
The there's devil a God.
And trembles.
Yes.
The word says he trembles.
Yes.
But this guy's not even trembling. He's afraid of the dying and the half that's going to hurt, but he wasn't afraid of what's going to be on the other side of eternity.
Which is far worse than whatever happened there on that
far
end of that
far
rope.
Worse for him. That's right.
In December of 1928, Gordon's mother, Louise Northcott, was convicted of the murder of Walter Collins. She was released after spending only 14 years in prison.
Still a shame.
She was paroled on May 30th in 1940.
So
that would have been 12 years. So she spent 12 years in prison. Okay.
None of it is enough.
I mean,
honestly, she should have faced the death penalty and been executed as well.
Yeah.
She really should have.
It's highly possible. We talked about this. I don't know if murderers are born or if they are made. She may have very well created.
She played a part in that.
Oh yeah.
Her actions and how she played a part in that big time.
Definitely. But listen to this. So in 1931, her husband, George Northcott, mm-hmm. he had left California. Obviously, I mean, he probably didn't want to show his face around there. And he bought this little farm in Parsonsburg, Maryland. Well, when she was paroled, she moved back in with him and spent the rest of her life on that farm.
He allowed that?
In Parsonsburg. Yep.
See, I feel like he should have done some time as well.
Yeah. Oh, I did too.
Although he did not participate, he did not stop this. No. He should have done time.
I agree.
And then
I think today he would have.
Oh, I hope so. Then you have poor Sanford, who, how long was he in reform? Oh, you're going to get to him.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I won't.
So George died in April of 1944, and his wife, she died 7 months later on November 21st in 1944, and everything they owned was left to their only surviving child.
Winifred.
I would do want to end by talking about Sanford, but why don't you tell us what ended up happening with Christine Collins?
Okay. So as far as Christine goes, where I left off with my story and yours came in was when she had been released from the psychiatric ward after being put there very unjustly.
Yes.
And we had some discussion in part one about the discrepancy of those dates of how long she was held. And I felt like that September 11th date was accurate because that was actually the date that came from the text of her lawsuit against Jones that she brought against Captain Jones.
Okay.
However, I want to note that the LA Times printed on September 25th a quote from her. And in that quote, she says, that she was detained from 8th of September until the 13th.
Wow.
And it was the 14th, the very next day, that Sanford showed up.
So she sued.
She did sue.
Okay, good.
So here's what happened with that. On the 15th, Captain Jones finally revealed to the media that Mrs. Collins had returned a few days before that and had insisted that this boy was not her son. And that was just another instance of him hiding the facts to cover his butt.
Right.
Because, you know, she had actually... Oh, he said that she had told him the previous day, the 14th. But she had actually told him on the 8th.
Yeah. And then he threw her in the insane asylum.
And of course, he didn't bother to mention that he had had her detained in the madhouse.
Right.
Yeah. So Christine is out. Finally, she goes to the county grand jury and she asked for an investigation of her arrest.
Good.
And they handed the case over to the police commission. On October 16th, the hearing was put before the police commission to investigate claims that Mrs. Collins had been ill-treated by Captain Jones and had been illegally detained. One of the psychiatrists that had examined the boy that was brought to him by Captain Jones testified that he had told Mr. Jones that he would stake his life on it that this was not Walter Collins. That's a direct quote.
Wow.
Witness after witness made similar assertions. Neighbors, family members, and even Walter's teacher all said they had tried to inform the captain, but to no avail. So he truly was just rejecting this information. Jones never even testified in that hearing, and yet he was not given any disciplinary action.
Are you serious?
Because, quote, the boy had managed to fool many others as well. The boy that was acting like Walter. So Christine, at this point, this is when she decided to get a lawyer, and she filed a civil suit against Jones, the police chief Davis, the one who, in the introduction, James Two Guns Davis.
Yes.
And the city for $500,000. You think that's a lot of money back then, too.
Oh, yeah.
And the public really, they rallied around her for that injustice that had been done. There was one player in particular who was very helpful to Christine. He was clergyman Reverend Gustav Brigleb, and I may be butchering that name, of the Trinity Methodist Church. He was a very outspoken advocate for Christine, and that was somewhat due to his ongoing public calls for the case to be reopened that kept her case from dying right then. He pretty much helped force the city council into another hearing. At that hearing, Jones does not testify, but Police Chief Davis did testify. But he was, like, very resistant to the questions. He wasn't very forthcoming. He was being, you know, kind of obstinate. This council did ask for the resignation of Chief Davis and a permanent suspension of Jones. But the wheels of justice moved slowly. November arrived, and the city councilman by the name of Carl Jacobson, who had himself been the victim of a police frame-up just the year earlier, he demanded they turn that case over to a grand jury. And yet, still no further disciplinary action was taken against Jones. They did extend his suspension by 4 months. I mean, this is it. He's gotten suspended. It was temporary, and now they've extended it by 4 months. But, like, no real discipline. On December 7th, Christine, that's when she went and met with Gordon. At this time, that criminal case against Northcott was going on.
Right.
And so Jones, he wouldn't testify in the civil case because he said, you know, it might mess up those proceedings.
Poot.
Yeah, so he used that as his excuse. In July of 1929, her civil case goes to court. One of the witnesses for the defendant, Chief Davis, a mental specialist, quote unquote, testified that it wouldn't hurt anyone to be confined for a few days in a psych ward. He had the cojones to continue with. In fact, it might even be beneficial. Like, what the heck? And as if that's not enough, the arrogant Captain Jones acted as his own attorney, asked questions of himself, and answered them. Who does that sound like?
Wow, okay.
I mean, like, he's... He expressed that he felt that Reverend Brigleb had induced her to bring that case against him, and he was out to get him. And can you believe that this case ended in a mistrial?
Are you serious?
Yep, the jury was divided, even after all that evidence in her favor.
Wow.
But I give kudos to Christine. Early the next year, she pursued that suit again. And this time, she didn't ask for the $500. She only asked for a little over $50,000 in damages. And this time, she did win the judgment.
It's not going to bring her son back, but I'm so glad that she got something.
Yeah. Well, she got the judgment. I mean, she got the decision that she wanted.
She probably never saw a dime.
Unfortunately, she did not. The award was reduced down to just $10,800. And she said she planned to use that money to help in the search for her son. So she still was searching for Walter.
Bless her heart.
But she has so much tenacity.
She does.
So although she never received a dime from Captain Jones, he continued to hedge and haw and delay, not paying her, trying to appeal to get a new judgment. Never would own up to what he did. He always claimed he really thought she was crazy when he had her detained due to the loss of her son. Her lawyer even tried to force the police department to enforce the judgment because the law does state that an officer has to pay his debts. And that was to no avail. He acted like he didn't have the money. He couldn't afford it. And then, and to add insult to injury there, in 1934, he made her an offer of $500.
Huh?
$500. And she had been awarded $10,800. She had sued for $50,000. And he's offering $500 because he wants it to go away.
Oh, my God.
That's just arrogant and insulting.
It is.
And this was a legal judgment. It's not like you can just go, offer your way out of that anyway.
Right.
Like, who gets to do that?
Seriously.
So that just goes to show his own narcissism. Of course, her lawyer refused to take that insulting $500, and he continued to press the police department or the police commission to make Jones pay, and they never would. Chief Davis actually said no further action was necessary. I mean, the poor officer had already been suspended without pay for 4 whole months. But Christine and her lawyer, they did continue to renew that case every 5 years because you have to renew it. If you have an unpaid judgment, you just have to keep going and staying on it every 5 years. And they did do that for a long time. After 10 years, she still has not seen one red cent from Jones.
Wow.
I mean, it just infuriates me. And then what's more intriguing, because this poor guy can't afford to pay her, but in 1940, he and his wife took a round-trip cruise to the Orient.
Are you serious?
Yes. And how infuriating is that? We don't know if Christine continued to file that case after 1941 because we don't have any more records to show. Captain Jones, he died in 1951, not having paid her anything. She lived until 1964, and as we've already established, she actually always held out hope that Walter was not one of the boys that was killed. As much as Gordon Northcott's mother doted on him and had an unnatural motherly bond with him, Walter Collins' mother loved her son just as much.
Yes.
Her love, however, did not culminate in perverted and sick actions on his behalf, but in the determination to set wrongs right and to fight for justice for herself and for her son until the day she died.
Oh, I love that. Wow. I mean, I hate it, but I love it.
Yeah. I mean, I love that she still, she could have just let that drive her crazy for real. I mean, I can understand that. But she stood up and fought against those injustices. And that may have helped somebody down the line, even though she didn't get a dime of it. I do want to also add, because we talked a lot about the police corruption that was going on.
Right.
And I am a firm supporter of the Boys in Blue.
Yes.
Unfortunately, in every station of life, there are people who lack integrity and morals.
Yeah.
And this was just a time when that was really rampant. And so while there was a lot of police corruption going on back then and city officials, we can credit that district attorney that you were talking about for his integrity and his actions. And also the person who started bringing down this police department later on was also another officer who had witnessed it. He was an ex-police officer, and he started an investigation of his own, and his name escapes me right now. But the work of those two really offset
combat
what was going on.
Yep.
They do. And so I just wanted to say that.
Well, Sanford Clark, he was never tried for murder, thankfully.
Yeah.
Because the assistant district attorney, Loyal Kelly, believed that Sanford, he was a victim. He was a victim of his Uncle Gord Northcott's sadistic abuse. And any questionable thing he did was out of fear for his own life. He never believed that Sanford was a willing participant in those murders. After the trial, Mr. Kelly found Sanford kind of a unique setup because they had to do something because he had admitted to participating
right
in these murders, even though it was, I mean, they knew he needed something.
Yeah. I mean, it was coerced, but
they couldn't just completely do nothing. This, I believe, ended up being so good for him anyway. After the trial, Sanford was sent to the Whittier Boys School, which actually was an experimental program for delinquent youths. But this particular program was unique because of its compassionate mission.
Okay, so it seems like they really handpicked that one for him.
Yes, the boys lived in cottages with house parents, with a mother and a father who really cared about them.
Oh.
They worked and they went to school, and he didn't have to go in there and tell anybody. Nobody knew.
Oh, good.
Or, you know, he was getting counseling, but he didn't have to tell his peers.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that really sounds like the best case scenario for him, because if they had just turned him out on the street, what would he have done?
Exactly. And he was met there with genuine compassion.
Oh, that's so good.
Yeah. Sanford was sentenced to 5 years at the Whittier School, but his sentence was commuted to 23 months because Sanford had impressed the trustees there with his good nature and his hard work ethic.
Wow.
And his living a productive life during his time there. I mean, they were truly impressed. When Sanford was released, he was deported back to Canada. And guess who took him to the boat?
His sweet sister.
No, his sister was back in Canada.
Oh, he's going to her.
Mr. Kelly.
Mr. Kelly.
Yes, he took him there. And on that dock, oh, this is going to make me want to cry, but
I know, I've been like tearing up the whole time.
Him and Mr. Kelly made a deal that Sanford would use his life to prove that rehabilitation does work. Mr. Kelly said to him, go prove that I'm not wrong about you, that I was right about you. He dedicated his entire life to fulfilling that request. It was the least he could do for the man who had done so much for him and who truly believed in him. He lived... Oh, okay.
I know. It's just so hard.
I know. He went back to Canada and lived with Jesse. He built a relationship and became very close with his younger brother and even his father, who had been so distant with him when he was younger, but, you know, probably just had so many regrets.
Wow.
And they were able to, you know, rebuild that relationship. He hardly had anything ever to do with his mother ever again. Yeah. I don't think he was a person who was just mean, but I just think he kept his he did see her a handful of times, but not much.
He probably could never look at her the same again.
Probably not. And his son, Jerry Clark, would later say that it was the love of his wife, June, the love of his sister, Loyal Kelly, and the Whittier State School for helping rehabilitate Sanford from the horrors that he experienced at the hand of his uncle, Gordon Northcott. Sanford would go on to serve in World War II. He worked for 28 years for the Canadian Postal Service. He married the love of his life, a woman named June. Sanford would not have any biological children of his own because he was afraid of passing on whatever bad gene was in his family.
Mm.
But he and his wife did adopt and raise two sons. And Sanford was married for 55 years and was always involved in charity and community service. Sanford Clark died in 1991 at 78 years old, and he was buried in the Woodlawn Cemetery at Saskatoon, Saskatchewan in 1993. Although he lived an exemplary life, He struggled until the day he died with extreme guilt and deep depression from time to time, even to the point of wanting to take his own life. But he never stopped fighting to keep his promise to Mr. Kelly. And that just, that perseverance is, it's something.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. But, wow, those were some hard times.
They sure were.